KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
University of Washington.
Hey, here's a blast from the past. This show's been out a long time. I'm Steve Scherer. Welcome to Weekday for a Tuesday, April 30th. John Talton's going to be here in a little bit. We're going to talk to John Talton, not about economics, but about his books. He's written 10 books, mysteries. He's going to tell us about them. We're also going to hike today. We're going to hear from the governor about the special session. But we start this hour, the NBA. They've thrown cold water on pro basketball's return to Seattle in the near future. In a unanimous vote yesterday, the league's seven-member relocation committee said the Kings franchise should stay put in Sacramento. There'll be a full vote soon, but it looks like the dream may be postponed. Art Thiel is co-founder and editor of Sports Press Northwest. Art, the dream postponed, huh?
Oh, I don't know. That was bad news. There was no doubt that Sonics fans got kicked in the teeth by this news. I don't know that it was altogether that surprising, given what David Stern, the NBA commissioner, was doing in the last couple of months. He basically grew the food, made the groceries, and cooked the meal for the Sacramento Kings to come up with a counter offer. And maybe he's going to chew the food and swallow it, too.
Well, here's what David Stern had to say about the decision. He was talking on NBA TV from the sideline of last night's Pacers-Hawks game.
As strong as the Seattle bid was, and it was very strong, there's some benefit that it should be given to a city that has supported us for so long and has stepped up to contribute to building a new building as well.
Wow, he didn't say that about the Sonics when they were taken out of town, did he?
No, he conveniently overlooked that, and I know that irony has further enraged the constituency about how dare he say that when he screwed over the Sonics in their 41 years. But there was a difference, and that difference was I-91. Sports fans like to forget this little bit of political theater that happened in November of 2006, but it meant the world to David Stern. And I-91 said that any pro team that's going to lease Key Arena has to return a modest profit, the equivalent of a T-bill, which really is hardly sinister and probably a pretty progressive idea. And, of course, we're full of progressive ideas in Seattle. But David Stern took that message as drop-dead NBA, and certainly with a 74-26 margin, it was drop-dead. But nobody in Seattle opposed it because they didn't understand it.
Well, you better explain it again to me, because I'm not quite sure I see why he would be so upset about that vote.
Well, he took that vote as the city of Seattle repudiating pro sports, because pro sports is so used to getting sweetheart deals on their leases that it's become a fact of life. This is the entitlement of the monopolist. And the upshot of that is that when Stern saw how much the vote was so lopsided, he just said Seattle does not care about the NBA or pro basketball, and it made the decision for him to not engage like he has in Sacramento much easier because the citizens had spoken.
I see. And then I guess we can't read his mind about what he thought about taking the team away, but that was part of it then, perhaps.
Yeah, it was the Bennett buying the team in July of 06 certainly was the start. In November of that year, the vote took place, and after that, there were efforts to keep the Sonics, but they were, you know, futile because it was clear Clay Bennett had an agenda to move the team to Oklahoma City, and Stern wasn't going to stand in the way because he said, "I've seen how Seattle, the electorate feel. They said 74-26 to get out," and he's never forgotten that, and he will bring it up if you mention it every time. This is not an idle, insult. This was it was an electoral declarative, and the more that Seattle forgets that, the more they are misdirecting their emotions. We made a decision.
You call him King David.
Yeah.
He's been around for a long time and may yet be around for a long time. So what does that mean for, if that's his, if that's what's stuck in his craw, what does that mean for Seattle even getting something like the elusive expansion team?
Well, I think that, you know, David has his grudges, but he's also not an idiot. He knows that, in fact, he's a very smart man, and he's playing Seattle like a fiddle right now. I tweeted and I wrote this morning, I said that Seattle is to the NBA what the vacant Los Angeles market is to the NFL. It's a way to extort municipalities who are arguing with their teams over leases.
I see. Who want? Do you want to be like Seattle? That's what he's saying to these folks?
Right. Yeah, he's basically saying, you don't think we'll move a team? Look at what we did to Seattle. And so it's a stalking horse, and that's what the NFL does with L.A. There hasn't been a team there since 95, but every team that's had an argument with its municipal government over a lease, they say, we're going to L.A., and they get their lease. So this is the game that Stern is playing right now, and he's absolutely infuriated Steve Ballmer. And if you know anything about Steve Ballmer and his reputation and his temper in this thing, that would seem to be ill-advised.
Why?
However,
hey, what's he going to do, like have the blue screen of death show up on the NBA computers?
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Steve has his ways. So I'm really, you know, as exhausted as I am of this story, I'm now really intrigued because David Stern is Ballmer's equal in terms of being obstinate, volatile, temperamental, and easily irked. So this is going to be a real interesting thing because most lawyers would advise Seattle not to sue the league for all the obvious animosity it creates. But on Chris Hansen's website last night, he posted a message that it's not over. He said that he has several options, numerous options, actually, for completing the transaction of buying the Kings and bringing the NBA back to Seattle. It was a very feisty, aggressive tone, and he ended his little message by quoting Muhammad Ali saying, impossible is nothing. And I was just amazed that this story has taken yet another turn that was not anticipated. I didn't expect that Hansen was going to take it, you know, lying down, but that was a real drop in the gloves and starting to bare knuckle with David Stern.
That's interesting. As such, he wrote, we plan to unequivocally state our case for both relocation and our plan to move forward with the transaction to the league and owners at the upcoming Board of Governors meeting in Mid-Bay. They have a binding transaction to purchase the Kings. So where does that leave him? Let's say he buys that part of the team, $350-plus million.
Right.
What does that give him by way of leverage? And where's the lawsuit possibility coming from?
Well, I mean, it could be an awkward transaction. I don't know that Chris wants to buy a team and operate it in Sacramento because that would replicate the ordeal that happened here in Seattle with Clay Bennett. You know, Bennett bought the team and operated it here for 2 years, and he ran it into the ground, got a bunch of high draft choices, and now the Oklahoma City Thunder are one of the best teams in the NBA. But they're not in Seattle. So that is a very dubious outcome, and I don't think the NBA Finance Committee would approve that sale knowing what Hansen's agenda is. So litigation, it seems to me, the threat of litigation might be useful, but actually litigating this I think would be a dubious maneuver on Hansen's part. Now, there's a possibility that Hansen could sue the Maloofs, or he could sue Sacramento for interference. I think they call it tortious interference. I'm no lawyer. You might want to get one on to explain that. But it's been told to me that if a binding purchase and sale agreement is violated because somebody interfered with one of the parties, the other party has an option to sue. The Maloofs can't sue because when you join the NBA, part of the rules of engagement is that you have no legal recourse against the league or any of its members. So the issue would, you know, I think what Hansen would like to do is make a very dramatic, improved presentation, denigrating the Sacramento enterprise and saying you people are fools if you turn this thing down. And it will also give another 2 weeks before the May 13th vote or shortly thereafter to see that Sacramento's deal is perhaps made out of straws and balsa wood. That's what the Seattle people think. It's just it's a thrown together deal for obvious reasons. They've only had 3 months to do it, but it won't stand up either the ownership or their arena plan. So that's Chris's strategy.
It's interesting, Art Thiel of Sports Press Northwest. It's interesting that you have. Michelle Rhee said about her husband, Kevin Johnson, he doesn't like to lose. He plays for keeps. You have Mike McGinn, basketball player, known for throwing elbows, I believe I heard one time. And Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer, all kind of guys are in the sport. So maybe we're just watching them mix it up off the court like they would on the court.
These guys are very successful business people. They've won a lot. And they don't like to lose. They really don't like to lose. I mean, this is not some 9-year-old crying because he lost a softball game. These guys don't like to lose on the international global level. And this is what this has become, because the NBA is the most globalized of the American sports. And there's a lot at stake here. And everybody involved in domestic and international sports is watching this very, very closely, because it's going to set some pattern or some trend. It's already set a record for franchise valuation. The $550 that Hansen has proposed is a record for an NBA franchise, and everybody in the NBA secretly loves it because it floats all of their boats in terms of franchise valuation. But they're not going to say that publicly. They're just going to say no to Chris Hansen. And, ooh, does that make you mad?
Art Thiel's our guest. All right, Art, let me just ask you for a reaction here. Jason Collins, I'm a 34-year-old NBA center. I'm black, and I'm gay. What does it mean for pro sports, really, that he has come out?
Well, it's a step forward that, you know, has been long overdue. There is the minor question that Jason may not be on a team next year because he's 34 and at the end of his career. But the point was he has been an active player. He decided to take this step forward, and I admire him for his courage, and now there needs to be others who are more actively engaged in their sport to do this so we can put this behind us, like in sports, as we did segregation in sports and lots of other things that have gone by the wayside, and sports has been a leader in these sorts of things. It's a little late, but it's most welcome.
Yeah, he sort of said that in his essay. He said, you know, I'm standing up so others will do it and feel less. I was hoping somebody else would do it, but that didn't happen, so I've done it, and I hope others will follow.
Yeah, it is a watershed moment. But the interesting thing is there's going to be a real conflict. There, you know, nobody or very few athletes are going to say they're bothered by a gay guy in the locker room. But I know that there is a strong Christian element in sports that will by definition resent this development. And every time we see players take a knee after a game to pray for, I don't know, touchdowns or success or health or whatever, those folks are going to have a very uncomfortable time when this becomes widely accepted.
All right, Art Thiel is co-founder and president of SportsPressNorthwest.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Art_Thiel, T-H-I-E-L, at Art Thiel on Twitter. Thank you, sir. I look forward to talking to you again.
All right, my pleasure, Steve.
Take care. Art Thiel, this is Weekday.
Take your high tops and your whack shots to the hot shop, because in the supersonic hop, we don't play slop. And if you're coming to to the crib, you're bound to get jacked. I'll take that J back, fool, cause we ain't having that. And this house suits rarely are defeated. And other teams come and get severely mistreated. Thinking you're about to take the Supersonics out.
It's 9:20. John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He's also a mystery novelist. We'll talk with him about his latest work of fiction, The Night Detectives, in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
Weather-wise in Seattle, it's 44 degrees and cloudy. We're expecting clouds and showers this morning, but then partly sunny this afternoon with a high today of 57. It's 9:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A talk with Governor Jay Inslee in 20 minutes.
John Talton frequently comes on our show on weekday, on Wednesdays, but he's not just an economics columnist. He doesn't just think about economics. He's also a mystery writer. The Night Detectives is his 10th novel. Takes us from the familiar haunts of Phoenix to the seedy side of San Diego with his main character, David Mapstone. Good to see you on a Tuesday, sir.
I am happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here. I'm enjoying this book. What do you think? Sonics not coming here? You said you knew Kevin Johnson as a player, I mean, when you were in Phoenix, right?
I actually grew up with the Phoenix Suns. I was there as a toddler in their first season, because I'm only 26.
Yes, I understand that.
And but KJ was a star locally in Phoenix when I was a columnist down there in the early 2000s. He was there. He wanted to go back to Sacramento and rebuild the center city of his hometown, and he became the mayor. It's hard to feel good about taking another city's team, as they will tell you in Oklahoma City. And a man who has the integrity and fair-mindedness of Clay Bennett, who's over the relocation committee, of course we could expect from him a process that combined dignity with probity.
I'm curious to hear how the discussion will unfold about economic impact or lack thereof now as we move into a mayoral campaign where people are going to be looking at what was invested, what's not invested. People look at other community groups and their impact, from the arts groups to the Pacific Science Center to what's happening with the aquarium. I mean, everybody kind of makes an economic argument for their impact in the city and where investments should take place. This kind of puts that in perspective, maybe, or maybe it's going to just raise it a little bit. Everybody will be looking at it.
Well, the argument is always that if you put X hundreds of millions of dollars from that arena into transit or public education, wouldn't it be better for the community? But that X hundreds of millions of dollars aren't available for those things. And typically you've got 30 cities who have thought this is a good idea, and they're not all fools. One can make the argument that professional sports are an asset that helps recruit talent. It'll probably happen eventually. My colleague Jerry Brewer has a great bitter column today where he raises the point of the fans disappointed yet again. Will they hang around?
Yeah, I read that. He was bitter.
I'm good at bitter columns, but he outdid me.
All right, John, I am enjoying The Night Detectives. I knew I was in the hands of a master and a writer I enjoyed when you had this line. This is your character, David Mapstone. My mind was a bad neighborhood. I didn't want to wander around there alone. I thought that was very nice.
Well, you know, David is a defrocked professor of history who went back home to Phoenix. And he took a job as a deputy for his friend, who is now the sheriff, who is not like the real sheriff down there. He's a Mexican-American named Peralta, and he respects civil liberties. And you follow the arc.
This is science fiction.
Exactly. Well, you follow the arc of the series from Concrete Desert on, and that it's now been the series has now been going on for 12 years. And in the latest arc, the sheriff has been defeated in an election precisely because he's Mexican-American. And so he and David strike out on their own, as private detectives, and this is their first case.
Would you describe where their offices?
Well, their old offices used to be downtown and were quite plush.
When they were in the police
when they department. Were in the sheriff's office.
The sheriff's
and now they are out on Grand Avenue, which makes Aurora look like the Champs-Élysées. And they are in the remains of an old auto court. In other words, one of these little motels that sat by highways. And the only thing that remains is the bulldozed parking lot and the one office building. And it's this kind of ramshackle adobe affair, and that's where they have set up their practice.
With a big fence and a big air conditioner. That's one of their additions, right?
One of the additions that Peralta made, because he's got the money, because his ex-wife was a very popular radio psychologist, and she left him a bunch of money. So he invested in a big security fence, and he invested in the essential down there, a big new air conditioning unit.
And then I think you actually describe it. There's either in a picture or something that it was kind of a quaint and attractive little auto court of a culture that is no more.
That was a city that had these neon auto courts on the highways headed into town. And it was a beautiful and magical thing all through the 50s and even into the 60s. I even remember it.
You know, John, you try as hard as you might. Your love of your hometown of Phoenix still kind of comes out in all these books. You are forlorn for it, but there's something you love about that town?
Sure.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, they don't love me so much, but because I speak the truth to power. But I wrote the first Mapstone mystery, Concrete Desert, when I was in Cincinnati, and I like to think it was a love letter back home. I never thought I would go back there to write a column, which I did for 7 years. And so, yes, all of these have the city as a character. My inspiration was Raymond Chandler in Los Angeles. People who go down there for spring training say, oh, there's no history there. It's all these look-alike houses. But they don't know the Phoenix that I know, nation's sixth largest city, and all of the history and the culture that's there. It sits upon the old Hohokam civilization, which was the most advanced irrigation civilization in the Americas.
I didn't know that.
Yes. And when the European settlers came there in the late 19th century, they cleaned out the canals. It's in one of the world's great alluvial valleys. Plant something there, water it, it will grow. And so the name Phoenix, as in rising from the ashes of the previous civilization, is very apt, and Mapstone knows all these things, but he lets the history go down with a drip of sugar.
Cleaning out the canals was a good idea then?
Well, you will have people who say we just wanted to keep it with 2,000 people in saguaros. But, yeah, I mean, it made possible that and reclamation, because Phoenix, for all of its right-wing tendencies, not in the city but in the metro area, is a total creation of the federal government, the dams on the Salt River, the canal from the Colorado River. Phoenix is the most perfect example of socialism in America.
How does that notion, that historical notion, play into this series with David Mapstone?
Well, David, like me, is a native, and I'm a fourth generation. My family came there when it was just this awful, dusty place. And on Rogue Columnist, I have a series called Phoenix 101, which is about the history, and one is called Phoenix 101, Why They Came. And David knows all this history. He carries it around with him. But he's in a city of 4 million people, 95% of whom know nothing of the history, 95% of whom came from the Midwest. And they say, oh, there's no history here. This is brand new. It's a blank slate. But David knows it's not. David knows it has a great mob history. It has a tremendous history of murders and bodies being found out in the desert. It has this moody atmosphere, the ghosts of the Hohokam, and he tries to bring all this out. He can't help himself.
Yeah, because he's an intellectual.
Absolutely.
I was trying to remember if you follow him in any ways in terms of your training. You weren't a historian by training, right?
I actually was, and I was warned by my PhD advisor, and this is not a joke, that I wrote too clearly to be a professional academic historian. And so I did not go on to get my PhD, but I also was a paramedic for 4 years, during which time I rode along with cops a lot, and I have a lot of police friends.
I just think that's very funny. You wrote too clearly. I think we've all seen that academic writing. When did you start writing these, the mysteries? Were they part and parcel to your evolution as a journalist and an economics columnist?
Well, this was my attempt to get out of the newspaper racket, and you see how that's worked out. But I first wrote the initial David Mapstone mystery in 1995-96. And it took me 4 years to get it published because I did not go to an Ivy League school and I did not live with an Alfred A. Knopf editor in Greenwich Village and go to those parties. And it is such an incestuous world.
Another mistake you made.
I know. But St. Martin's finally picked it up through a very Byzantine process. And it was published in 2001. And since then, there's 10 books. Not all in the Mapstone series. There is also a series set in Cincinnati called the Cincinnati Casebooks. And then the one thriller that I wrote, I set in Seattle called Deadline Man. And it's about an economics columnist for a major metropolitan newspaper that is not the Seattle Times.
Yeah, what was it, the Seattle Free Press?
The Seattle Free Press.
You had some good reviews for that. Are you going to bring that character, that back as well?
Well, series are this burden you carry around with you. Publishers like series, readers like series because they can get into the characters. And with Deadline Man, I said, I'm not going to write it as a series. I may write another Seattle book, but there's lots of books set in Seattle.
Yeah. There's always room for one more, isn't there?
Well, who knows what might happen next.
By the way, I think I read Powers of Arrest. Yeah, Powers of Arrest. Following the Pain Nurse. Powers of Arrest, that's a gritty and that's not the right word. Lurid is too far. I don't mean lurid. I want to take it a step notch down from there. It's realistic.
Yes, it's realistic. Lurid is Deadline Man. It is louche in a fun way, as, of course, Seattle is. Powers of Arrest is a Cincinnati casebook. It follows homicide detective Will Borders and his friend Cheryl Beth Wilson, who is a pain management nurse, whom we met in the first book in that series called The Pain Nurse.
He seems a little more troubled than David Mapstone.
Well, they are troubled in different ways. Will is someone who had surgery in Powers of Arrest. He's out of the hospital but walking with a cane. He's a homicide detective, a stand-up guy, but he's been relegated to being the public information officer because he's walking with a cane. And yet a murder plops in his lap, and soon he and his old partner are investigating it, and this murder ropes in Cheryl Beth, who is another important character in the series. And Cincinnati is one of these cities like Seattle that has tremendous history and atmosphere and moodiness and hills and freaks out at a light dusting of snow.
Different than Phoenix.
Very different than Phoenix.
How long did you spend in Cincinnati?
I was there about 4 years.
As a journalist?
As a journalist. I was at the Cincinnati Enquirer.
Is there, you see these characters differently. Do they mean something different to you in terms of like how you write them, how you approach them?
Sure. I mean, when I am writing this, I will always ask Susan, my wife, as I'm reading it to her, I'll say, does this sound like Mapstone, if it's Deadline Man or a Cincinnati casebook? And if she says no, then I feel like I'm on the right track. Will Borders in the Cincinnati casebooks is not an intellectual, and none of the characters are. David is an intellectual, but not in an obnoxious way. And David goes to a much darker place as the series continues. Someone who's going to read The Night Detectives might read one or two of the earlier books first, because a new story arc starts here with the previous book called South Phoenix Rules, which got many starred reviews from the top reviewers. And then Deadline Man is the only newspaper book that I ever wrote, and people will look at that and say, ah, that's you back in the day. And I, well, probably.
Well, probably.
Without some of the black ops part.
Yeah.
And if it was, I couldn't tell you. And if I did, I'd have to kill you, and there'd be a lot of dead air.
Yeah, it would be. But Mapstone, he's a little bit like you. You're an intellectual.
I've been accused of that. I used to say that Mapstone was a healthier-minded, thinner version of me, and now he's not as healthy-minded. The thing I regret is not writing from the dark side when I started Mapstone, because I wanted Mapstone to be much more of an idealized, healthy-minded character, and the love interest Lindsay the same way. And now I look at the Dragon Tattoo series, and I think, you know, Lindsay could have been Lisbeth Salander. On the other hand, Stieg Larsson is dead and I'm not.
Yes, that's right. By the way, I know you're an intellectual because you used the word louche, which I had never even heard before.
Well,
I had to look it up. An energy generated by all organic life in varying degrees of purity. That's one definition, but I think you were using this definition. The act of being fly in an innovative way.
And it also means kind of a degenerate of the flesh. But yes, I was using definition number one.
Yes, of course you were. You have gotten nice reviews. So I read many nice reviews, and Amazon lists all the Kirkus and Booklist reviews. They've all been very nice. Why aren't you a multimillionaire living in a mansion on one of the San Juans?
I don't know how one gets anointed. That's what I call it. As I say, if you went to an Ivy League school and you moved into New York and you did an internship at Newsweek and you lived with an editor at Knopf and you went to those parties and you went to the Iowa Writers Workshop and got to know Dennis Lehane, it truly is that incestuous. Now, you have to bring a certain level of expertise and skill. But if you went to a state university in the West and you worked for no names here and you worked for newspapers that were not the New York Times, very good newspapers, but not the New York Times, I could say this is John Talton at the Times.
You could say that.
I could say that. But that's like the people who say, I work at the WSJ, but they mean the Winston-Salem Journal, not the Wall Street Journal. Then it is a lot harder to break out. And especially now, anybody can be published. Now, being published by a legitimate house that gets you distribution into bookstores, that's different.
Now, what about this? What's going to happen with this book, Night Detective? Where's it going to end up? It's a legitimate house. You
it
have
is.
Distribution.
It is. And one always hopes that it's the breakout book. Nowadays, I think I need to write this fast-moving thing that involves the Vatican and artifacts and, you know, going to Geneva and Tokyo. And,
you could whip that through Phoenix pretty easily, couldn't you?
Yeah, and quickly through Scottsdale and then back out to London to get there. But one has hope.
I'm still thinking about you getting Tom Hanks to play David Mapstone flying into Phoenix and wandering around the city. How often do you go back to Phoenix?
I go back three or four times a year at least.
Family is still there?
Well, not on the right side of the grass, but a lot of friends and I keep doing Rogue Columnist. Largely for the readers I left behind.
Is that right?
Although it does have a national and even international readership when I write on those topics. But we still go back.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Is the city your muse? Might be the wrong word. But let's try that. Is the city your muse?
It is to an extent. Now, as a native Phoenician, nothing makes me more depressed than endless sunny days. And so Seattle in every way is much more comfortable and happy for me. But Phoenix is my muse, and every city needs its own private detective.
Well, that's for sure. I did not know, in reading The Night Detectives, I learned that Phoenicians, lovely phrase, use San Diego as their outlet in the summer.
Well, they do now. They didn't do that when I was growing up, but yes. And I actually worked in San Diego for several years back in the 80s, even though I'm 26. And I learned very quickly that you do not tell people that you're from Phoenix or Arizona because San Diegans hate them.
Really?
They like their money, but they hate that they overcrowd the city and they're not always the nicest people or drivers. San Diego drivers are very nice. Now, you get across the Orange County line and then you get nasty Southern California drivers. But San Diegans do not care for the Arizona influx.
We, well, similar to Washington State and Californians, at least for a while, much anymore. What we travel to San Diego with these two guys, we learn about the city, but it's always drawing them back to Phoenix. And I was wondering, is there a lot of that? I mean, is the connection between San Diego and Phoenix, is it really that strong these days?
Well, it is strong.
Was it 6 hours away by car?
Yeah, and Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport has service everywhere, multiple flights every minute to San Diego. San Diego is a place where Phoenicians go to get away from the hot weather. San Diegans do not come to Phoenix. And San Diego has this massive, robust, world-class economy now. It didn't have it when I was there. And Phoenix does not.
Yeah, why not?
Well, because all Phoenix ever wanted to do was get bigger and build a lot of houses and build a lot of freeways, and it's accomplished that, but it's a basket case as an economy.
Just to attract retirees? They thought the retirees would be the economy?
Well, I call it the real estate industrial complex. And so it got fat and happy doing this, and repeated efforts to build real industry clusters failed. And so Phoenix is a far more of a world city economically than Phoenix is, and culturally in every other way. You get what you pay for. In this book, Mapstone used to live and teach in San Diego, and his ex-wife is in San Diego. And so there's that magnetism that the average Phoenician doesn't feel.
Yeah. Is Ocean Beach a real place?
Oh, it is. I lived in OB. I lived a block and a half from the beach. It's in the city. It is south of Pacific Beach and Mission Beach, which is where most of the tourists go. And OB is this wonderful, eclectic community. It's as if you took Capitol Hill and slammed it up against this nice, sunny beach with sand. And it's still there, and it's still wonderful.
John Talton's latest book is The Night Detectives. So what do you see? You said you wish it had gone darker earlier. What do you see for David? He's going to continue, right? This series continues. You said it was a burden, but a burden and a blessing. So what do you see for him?
Well, one always has to get published again, but that seems to be okay.
I figured you're one of those writers that the publisher is just like looking at their watch saying, okay, when's the next one coming out?
I don't even know if I'll be able to log on to the Seattle Times email when I get out of this studio. I mean, in this business, you just never know. David is in a new world where he's a private detective. He's never done that before. In this book, in South Phoenix Rules, we kind of follow that evolution. And so I think he and his wife, Lindsay, they have issues individually and as a couple that will continue to influence the series. The darkness and corruption that are Phoenix will continue to be a big part of this series, as is all of the history and weirdness of Arizona. You know, Arizona, and especially Phoenix, is a place where people go to reinvent themselves. This has always been the true. It's why it's an old mob town. And bringing the city as a character along will no doubt be a big part of the next book, too.
John Talton is speaking at the Seattle Mystery Bookshop May 23rd at noon about his latest novel, The Night Detectives. part of the David Mapstone series. John Talton is also economics columnist of Seattle Times, blogs as Rogue Columnist at roguecolumnist.com, and visits us every few weeks to talk about the economy. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
This is Weekday.
A conversation with Governor Inslee in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Regional Heart Center, where patients from the Puget Sound area and throughout the Pacific Northwest region receive multidisciplinary comprehensive cardiovascular care. More information at uwmedicine.org.
What am I doing? What am I doing?
The world is so big and so wide and beautiful and exciting. There's so much out there.
Andrew Forstoffel set out at age 23 to walk across America. He brought a microphone and a sense of curiosity, and he met a whole lot of interesting people. Listen in on his journey this afternoon at 2.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral degrees in 40 programs. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
45 degrees in Seattle with clouds in the sky. Expecting clouds and showers this morning, then partly sunny later with a high of 57. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 65. Then we're expecting sunny days through the weekend with temperatures getting up into the 70s. So lots of sun and warm temperatures on the way. If you want to get outside, we'll get a recommended hike to match the week's weather in about 10 minutes or so.
But first, the gavel came down in the 2013 legislative session. Almost immediately, Governor Inslee told legislators they would be back for a special session in 2 weeks. They have to pass a budget, fund public education. Unlike many special sessions, this one will not focus on just those one things. There will also be a revisitation of the DREAM Act, reproductive privacy, maybe even gun legislation. Could get another round of discussions. But the governor says he intends to meet with leadership before the session begins in the hopes of coming to some broad agreements on the ways to pay for education while not cutting more social services.
The version of our future that I support is one where we choose schools over tax breaks, where we really recognize that our paramount duty is to our kids, you know, not to those who exploit these tax breaks. And that's a fundamental difference of a way to really put dollars into school that are necessary to give our kids jobs for the 21st century. And I think that's the fundamental difference. And it is a very, very wide gulf between the approaches at the moment. Yeah, having said that, though, we're going to solve this. Both parties are going to have to give up something in their viewpoints to reach an agreement, and I'll be helping them to reach the best agreement as rapidly as possible. We are going to have a balanced budget. It is going to put dollars into education, and I prefer it we put as much as we possibly can in a way that does not harm seniors, does not deprive children of help ending homelessness, and that's the issue. We just can't continue to cut medical and housing service for seniors and kids. That's an unacceptable way to finance education.
Now, Don Benton is the deputy majority leader in the Senate. He said this is too far apart. This is too long for now, that 2 weeks is not the right time. We should do it right away, not wait for 2 weeks for a special session.
Yeah, if the parties were closer, I would have agreed to try to finish up in a sprint to the finish. But they are so far apart that it's going to take a lot of spade work to get there and dig in a lot of trenches. And we do have to have some agreements on the fundamental numbers first. So I think 2 weeks, I would expect the legislative negotiators, and I'll be involved in that. We will have daily or close to daily meetings in my office about this to try to find the sweet spot of agreement. And hopefully then we could have a short session. Now, there's some other things we got to work on, too, though. The transportation budget. We need to figure out a way to finish the 520 bridge, Highway 167 in Pierce County, get the bridge across the Columbia River built. We cannot ignore that and how important that is to the economic and job picture of the state of Washington. And then we got some other issues to get done, too. We haven't done with protected a woman's right of privacy or the right to go to college under the DREAM Act or dealt with gun violence. So there's some other issues to get done. And I'm confident we have bandwidth to do that.
You know, Pam Roach, another Republican, said that she's never heard of a special session that is as broad as this one. It's just like going to another regular session. Can you really have all this accomplished in just a special session?
Sure we can. And the reason is that the real difficult issue is the operating budget. When that is resolved, that's the axle everything else revolves around. Once a deal is reached with the operating budget, we ought to be able to move forward with transportation and some of these other issues, like my effort to, in a bipartisan effort I'm working on, to have a much more vigorous approach to drunk driving. And I'm pleased to say we have about 95% after our meeting yesterday. I've been involved for hours the last few days putting together the finishing touches on a drunk driving assault. And so we can do that as well. We have to. We just can't wait another year to get these things done.
All right, let me come back to those three issues, but let me start with what you just said, what you said a little bit ago. What's the heavy spade work that needs to be done in terms of these numbers? What are you looking for in terms of a discussion about fundamental numbers?
Well, first, we have to get to real numbers. We can't allow people to try to build budgets on fictional assumptions.
So you think the Republicans' assumption about cost savings and lean management are not realistic?
I'm trying to be non-judgmental. This is a day for compromise and reasonableness, so I'm not trying to cast aspersions here. I will just say that it is a fundamental aspect. You have to build this on what you can actually bank and have a high degree of confidence on. You can't build a budget based on wishes, and we need some work in that regard. We can't and should not continue, as has happened for the last several years here, to reduce services to the elderly and seniors who need help just even getting out of bed in the morning. That has been cut. We've got to stop cutting our seniors. We've got to stop cutting the programs that help to reduce the 27,000 kids we have today who are homeless. That is not a solution to financing our schools. It's just too hard to educate a homeless, hungry, sick kid. That's not a solution. We've got to find a better solution, and I have offered that, as has the House, which is to close some of these tax breaks, like this tax break that was, you know, the oil and gas industries using $40 million of a tax break that was not meant for them at all when it was created. It's simply they have figured out a way to exploit a loophole that was not even meant for them.
And, you lost the fight on the beer tax, and in part it seems that was lost because the big beer companies basically were whispering a threat to even Democrats, saying we're happy to spend $1 million to take this up as an initiative. How are you going to, just on that aspect, how are you going to get some of these special tax breaks pushed, rescinded, when you have so much lobbying effort behind it?
Well, we've got 6.5 million Washingtonians who I believe have a very solid value system that our highest priority is to our kids. And when the choice is clear about whether you're going to continue to allow, for instance, oil and gas industry to use a $40 million loophole, that money would basically restore the Senate's cuts that cut $17 million out of subsidized child care of families trying to get child care while they go back to work, $11 million for long-term care services for the elderly, and $28 million for housing assistance, including families with kids that we want to get to school. So when you have a choice like that, I think those 6.5 million Washingtonians know that the choice is clear. We ought to be choosing our kids rather than that particular loophole, and you've got to tee it up on that choice and then ask legislators to do a hard thing. By the way, this is a hard thing. It's the reason it hasn't been done before. We haven't had leaders here who are willing to fight this battle and say, we're going to stand up for our kids and schools rather than these corporations. Now, that is hard, but we can do hard things, and we've got to this year.
Your expectation is you'll have success at the end of this 30-day session.
I do. Now, I'm a realist as well. I do not expect to have my exact budget adopted by the Republicans in the Senate. There is going to be a give and take. I understand that's the nature of democracy. But we're not going to allow tax breaks to victimize our kids. That's got to end.
That's your bottom line?
You bet.
All right, what about transportation? It looks like another thing Senator Don Benton said, that he wanted to draw a fence around the project going over the Columbia. He was afraid of cost overruns. I don't know that he's particularly happy of the idea of light rail going across that bridge. What should that bridge look like?
Well, we have got to understand a couple of things. This is the absolute artery for the economy of the state of Washington. This is a bridge resting on rotting wooden piers that were drilled into the mud in 1917. It has to be replaced. It's one small trembler away from not being serviceable, and our economy depends on that I-5 corridor. So the whole state has a stake to, in fashioning a solution to this problem. We have now been working for this project. It's been designed after hundreds of public meetings, $170 million of planning. This thing is ready to go. Oregon has put the money up for it. The federal government has put up $850 million for it. We are on the ready to go. The only thing that's keeping it from construction is the legislature not coming up with Washington's share of the project. So I think we need to move forward. We have to understand if we do not move forward this year, it will mean $170 million down the drain and no bridge at least for another 10 years because the federal money is going away next year. Ray LaHood, Republican Department of Transportation Secretary, came out and shared that troublesome information with us a couple weeks ago. So this is Fisher cut bait time. We've got to build a bridge. It's the year to do it. And if we don't do it this year, and anyone who's concerned about their taxes ought to keep this in mind, if we don't move forward with this particular project, we will end up paying it. Washington taxpayers will end up paying for this instead of getting $850 million from Uncle Sam. So I strongly believe this needs to be part of our project in transportation to keep our system moving. And I will be going down to Vancouver in the next few days to talk about our continuing effort to move this project forward.
All right, Governor, last question. I want to read you what Jerry Kornfield of Everett Herald said. Except when he tried to twist arms on a gun control bill, lawmakers in both parties used the politest terms in describing the arm's length Jay Inslee has kept from the process. He's talking about the process of getting legislation passed this season. What's your response to that?
Well, you're always looking for the right spot on how much the governor does or does not get involved in negotiations. I can tell you that I have been very, very personally involved in the last couple weeks. I've spent probably 6 hours working with Republicans and Democrats to fashion the finishing touches on this drunken drive bill. And if you'll call Roger Goodman, he'll tell you that this thing would not be moving forward like it is had I not put my shoulder to it. And I feel very strongly about this since I was prosecuting drunk driver cases and Snohomish County in Yakima County. So I am very engaged in this process. I'm committed to it, and frankly, I'm taking some chances here. Look, I'm hanging out and willing to step up to the plate on these closing tax loopholes. This does not happen. It is not easy. You will have the guns trained on you, metaphorically, by those who don't want to give up these tax breaks. But I'm willing to go to bat for our kids and schools, and we'll see what turns out.
It's Governor Jay Inslee talking about the special session and what could come from it. A little rain in the area today, but there is a place where there's not so much rain. Michael Fagan, who joins us to give us a hike to match the week's weather forecast, is thinking about over the mountains in Ellensburg. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Menashtash Ridge Observatory, huh?
Yeah, boy, that was a great hike. We did that yesterday. Good thing we didn't try to get over the pass yesterday. They had a foot of new snow at the pass.
Wow.
Yeah, it's anyhow, the weather is changing, and it's going to become more sunnier, excuse the English on that one, and very pleasant. This hike, you can do it several different ways. The road actually opens May 1st. We walked up last week. If you walk up, it's about a five-mile walk up the road, but starting tomorrow, the road opens up, and you could either drive up the road all the way to the top and wander around the ridge, or you could drive partway up and park, and if you have a GPS, you could wander around and have a good track back to your car. So a lot of different options, or if you're really hardy, do that 10-mile round-trip walk up and down. The bottom line is once you're up at the top, just phenomenal views, and we'll have these great views the entire week because it's going to be sunny starting this afternoon, right on through the weekend. And at the top, you get views of Mount Stewart, Mount Rainier, wildflowers are coming out. We saw a big elk herd. We saw about 50 of them, and that was really neat. And just want you to know, Monday through Thursday, there's going to be some rock blasting on I-90 at 7 p.m., so you want to get through there before 7 p.m. Monday through Thursday, Friday through the week, and no issues on the highway. One thing to mention, the observatory is run by UW. It's not staffed, so you can't get inside unless you make prior arrangements. And for parking purposes, you need a Discover Pass. We don't have a Green Trails map for this, but we do have a map and direction. So please take a look at the blog because the signage is not the best. We know that firsthand, but we have great detailed directions to get there. So that will be a great hike for this week.
Sounds great, Michael. Menashtash Ridge Observatory, hikewashington.net is the blog to look at. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather, LLC. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Bye.
Bye-bye. Weekday continues, and tomorrow, Mike Daisy on the program, talk about his latest work. Also, Deborah Madison talking about the diet. Duke, join us then, and the show continues ahead.
It's 10 a.m. News update from NPR in a minute. KUOW-FM, Seattle. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.